Hi everyone, it's Grace. Before we start our episode, I want to tell you about two things. First, the Where the Mountain Meets the Moon trilogy calendar I've been working on is finally out. It's available from the Eric Carle Museum bookstore, and if you purchase a book of mine at the same time, you'll get 10% off. The link is in the show notes. The second thing is that my other podcast, Kids Ask Authors, now has a Patreon page. Even if you don't listen to that podcast, becoming a patron helps this podcast too, since I produce both of them, and support would be greatly appreciated. And if you become a patron of that podcast, there are some really great perks, like the exclusive Random Question podcast only for patrons. On that podcast, I ask authors extremely random questions with always interesting answers. Don't you want to know what food Jason Reynolds can't bring himself to eat? Or what Jacqueline Woodson always buys at the grocery store? Become a patron of Kids Ask Authors to find out. The link is also in the show notes. Thanks so much, and now on to our episode.
Hi, I'm Alvina Ling.
And I'm Grace Lynn.
And we're book friends forever.
We're childhood friends that grew up to be
a children's book editor
and an author and illustrator.
Welcome to Book Friends Forever, the What to Do When Your Book Underperforms episode. Every week we catch up with each other's lives, talk about what's on our minds, and share with each other what we're grateful for.
And if you enjoy our podcast, please tell a friend about it and check out our website, bookfriendsforever.com. The website will include more detailed show notes as well as links to the episodes.
And please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. It helps with discoverability, so thank you everyone who has already rated and reviewed our podcast.
So, Alvina, how have you been?
I've been pretty good. My big news is that, well, I'm still loving Vermont. I've been here about 2 weeks now, and the big news is I bought a car.
Yay!
I know. I mean, I've been thinking about it for a while during this pandemic. You know, I think just feeling kind of stranded in Brooklyn and not feeling like I could escape without renting a car. And then renting a car also just felt like a little bit risky. So, yeah, since coming here and thinking that I might want to go back and forth, you know, to Brooklyn, it just made sense. And so I bought a used Prius. I wanted to be somewhat environmentally sound, and yeah, I love it. So,
did you buy it in Vermont?
I bought it in Vermont. If anyone is in Vermont and in the market for a used car, I bought it from a dealer called Earthy Cars, and actually, so it's a dealer just that specializes in environmentally somewhat friendly cars, like Priuses and other hybrids. And it was just really easy. It was just like a nice transaction.
Did you have to bike to get
it? Yes, I was about to say, yeah. So Stephen and I biked to the dealer, and it was about a mile, not a mile. It was like almost 5 miles, actually. So it took about an hour. And, you know, there were some hills. It wasn't so bad, but like right before the dealership, there was this really steep hill downhill, which was fun going down. But we, you know, in my head, I was like, we're definitely buying a car, so I don't have to like bike back up that hill. yeah, but we did. We bought it because we were pretty sure that I would, you know, find a car that I liked there, because I kind of honed in on Priuses, and they had like 4 Priuses like in my price range, and you know, with the mileage and the right years. So, you know, I thought like, of course one of them will work. And it was of course the first car that I test drove that I kind of fell in love with. So,
ooh, I bought it. What color is it?
It's kind of this, it's almost like this midnight blue. It's kind of an unusual color, which is why I kind of fell in love with it.
You have to give it a name.
You know, we named it. We decided to name her Earthy.
Aww.
No, sorry, not Earthy. Eartha. After, you know, kind of after Earthy Cars, but also, I don't know, we just thought Eartha, like Eartha Kit. It was like a nice name. So.
And it was the first one you test drove?
Yeah, we ended up only test driving 2 because, you know, the first one, there was nothing wrong with it. And then we thought, well, you know, we can test drive like 3 different 2015 Priuses, but you know what, I don't know, the first one was great, so, and we liked the color the best, so
mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's and that's
so it was
car.
Completely the same as the second.
The second one was actually an older car, an older Prius. I think it was 2009. So, you know, it was not as expensive, but it had much, you know, many more miles on it. So we thought to safe.
Yeah, especially if you're going to be driving back and forth from Vermont to Brooklyn, you probably want something with less mileage.
Yeah, and also it turned out, I mean, I haven't owned a car in 18 years. I sold my car in 2002 when I moved to New York from Boston. And so I don't really know much about cars. And, you know, the one car I bought, it was a used car that I bought from a friend's brother. So, you know, I've never bought from a dealership. But, you know, it turns out that if the car has under 100,000 miles, the dealer, at least in this case, the dealer's warranty is still intact.
Oh.
Yeah. And then the dealership gave a month long warranty, too. So, you know, I felt pretty safe.
Do you have any ideas about how you're going to park it in Brooklyn?
Well, Brooklyn, you know, it's funny, my neighbors ended up buying a car during this pandemic, too, and I was talking to them about it, because I said, oh, I saw you bought a car, how was that? And they've been parking on the street during the pandemic, but they said maybe permanently. They changed the street sweeping, you know, rules. So part of the reason why I hadn't really thought about having a car before, also I just haven't needed one, of course, but is that where I live, you have to move your car 3 times a week. And that just is, for me, having a job in the office would be really inconvenient. So, but during the pandemic, you know, I could move my car, no problem. But also if it's only 1 day a week, then that's fine. So they've been parking on the street. There's usually plenty of parking. Like whenever my friends come visit who have cars, and whenever I've had a rental car, I've never had trouble finding parking. So.
Oh, great.
Yeah, I just park on the street.
Should be fine. Nice.
Yeah. How about you? How have you been?
Good. I mean, really super, super busy. But like last week, we were talking about our daily routines and adjusting schedules. So I'm not sure how we talked about it, but I feel like when we were talking in our last episode, I sounded really reluctant to make any changes, which I really was. But I made a lot of changes, and I think it's working really well. So like, I'm getting up 30 minutes earlier. I'm walking a lot less, and cutting my exercise shorter. And also, it's getting cooler, so it's a lot easier for me to. We were talking about recovery time after craft camp. It's been easier for me to recover after craft camp. So it's been good. I've been getting stuff done, but it's like, what's that rule? Like, no matter how much time you have, you use it all up.
Yeah, I don't know what the rule is, but
it's like some kind
right.
of thing. So like, it's still super busy. The calendars I was working on, the Where the Mountain Meets the Moon trilogy calendars, they came in.
They're so beautiful.
Yeah, and they look so good. I'm so happy about them. They turned out really, you know, because you don't really know. And I'm so happy and relieved because I was like, what if they turn out terrible? I can't charge people if they look terrible. But they look great. So I'm really excited about putting those. Putting those for sale. I'm selling them through the Eric Carle Museum. So I decided that I would just let them handle all the distribution and everything because I was thinking, or maybe I'm hoping, that people who buy the calendar might also like to purchase a book of mine at the same time. So that way they could like put it together, like have a little gift. And since I don't have the capacity to do book sales, I thought it'd be nicer if the Carle Museum could send out the calendars and hopefully books as well. So it's all going to be through the Eric Carle Museum. So there's a link. I'll put a link in the episode about
Great.
It. So if people are interested, they can order. And also, like, there's so many other things. Like, I did the Patreon for the Kids Ask Authors is finally up. And I've been talking with people about pods more, and I'm still spearheading that. But now I'm feeling more hopeful than I have been before. Like, when I first started the conversation, it was not a lot of interest, but like as school has been starting to get closer and closer, I think people are realizing that we're going to need to do something, and I've been getting a lot more people who are interested and a lot more people like who want to be a part of it. So I'm feeling much more hopeful about that. So that's been really good, but also time consuming.
Yeah. That's good. It's been so interesting hearing from my friends who live, you know, elsewhere, what people are doing about school. You know, it's like, I would say most places are remote, but other places are hybrid. And yeah, it's just,
we should have your friends on again.
Heather and Fernando.
Yeah. Maybe we should. Maybe after school starts, like at the end of September or something, we should have them back on just to see. I think that would be really great.
Yeah, they'll have a follow-up, see what's going on in their school.
Yeah.
I wonder, they might not have time, they might be so crazed, but we'll see.
I know.
Yeah, I think it'd be interesting.
It's just finding time, because now I'm finally getting to paint, and I'm so happy about painting, but it's like, I only get like an hour here, or half an hour there, like I just can't wait until I can have like a big solid block of time, which I'm kind of counting on when the school year starts, and if I can get these pods to work, I'm like counting on just a big chunk of time. So like, I know it's not a good thing to put my hopes on, but I can't help hoping for it.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Okay, so today's episode is on the depressing topic of what to do when your book underperforms. So I thought we should first probably explain what we mean by a book underperforming. I define this as underperforming expectations. So it could be either your expectations as the author or maybe your publisher's expectations. You know, maybe you expected to win a big award or hit the bestseller list and you didn't do that. You know, that's an example. But I think from a publisher's point of view, though, the underperforming means that the book did not sell as many copies as we expected it to and that we budgeted it to sell. And I know as an author, you're not necessarily privy to what this number actually is. But I do think, you know, you kind of get a sense by like how much of an advance you were given, how much marketing money that you see that the publisher is spending. You know, because a different, you know, like a book can sell 10,000 and that would be like exceeding expectations, and a book can sell 10,000 and be underperforming. So Grace, how would you define underperforming?
Oh gosh. There's so many layers to underperforming, right? And I've had many, many a book underperform. So I think there's a couple of different ways that I look at a book and think about it, whether it underperforms. I guess the most heartbreaking underperformance is when you just kind of know that the book isn't finding its audience. You know, like nobody's talking about it, nobody's reading it. And that's not something that you can quite put your finger on, like how you know or why. Like there's books that I loved and I thought were like my best books ever, yet just somehow just didn't seem to find the audience that I thought it would have, you know?
Mm-hmm. Can you give
Yeah, yeah, for examples. Example, like I remember Where the Mountain Meets the Moon came out and it did very well, obviously, because it won the Newbery Honor, and people just seemed to really, really love that book. And I remember being so like happy and gratified about like all these people who are saying how much they loved it, you know, even before the awards, you know, like, and it was so nice and it was so heartwarming. It was a book of my heart. So I felt like, oh, it's so awesome that it's connecting with people. And once you get a taste of that, it's almost like drugs, right? Uh-huh. It's like, oh my gosh,
I made something that you would know.
Not me, no. But I assume it's just like drugs, because it's kind of like that high, because you've made something and you find people are connecting it and seeing it, you know? Uh-huh. And then I remember Starry River, the Sky, like I worked really hard on that and I loved it. And I actually thought it was a better book than Where the Mountain Meets the Moon.
Me too.
And it did fine, but it didn't hit the same way, you know, like, I mean, one of the things that I remember people saying were like, oh, I didn't connect with this book as much as Where the Mountain Meets the Moon. Or I remember somebody saying like, well, I read this book only because of Where the Mountain Meets the Moon. Why else would you read it? Like, kind of like this backhanded, backhanded compliment, you know, yeah. Like, and I remember just feeling so sad about that, because I remember thinking like, oh, I just thought it was kind of a companion book. I just thought it would kind of hit the same notes, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it didn't, but it underperformed, but I still don't think it was a failure. Does that make sense? Like,
right. Yeah. And it wasn't, I mean, you know, it wasn't a flop. Let's just say that, you know,
It wasn't a flop, but it definitely underperformed at least, emotionally to me, you know, like I felt like it didn't find the audience the way Where the Mountain Meets the Moon did. But then there's also, so that's one criteria I use, and that's probably the one that is, that stays with me the longest, right? But then there's the other criteria of just of sales and reviews, and those are the hardest in the immediate when the book comes out. Like, so reviews is really tough because A Big Moon Cake for Little Star had, I think, 4-starred reviews. Is that right? Or 5?
I don't remember. Yeah.
Anyway, it got a number of starred reviews, and I was very happy about that, and I'm so grateful for those. But I remember when A Big Bed for Little Snow came out, and it only received 1-starred review, and I remember feeling like, oh no, I let everybody at Little Brown down. I let everybody, you know, like, and like that, it's that feeling that like, oh no, I let everybody down, and the book underperformed, you know, like, so that's one thing. And then sales, of course, sales is just, sales is the toughest, right? And the perfect example of that would probably be my Mulan book.
Okay.
Because.
Well, it also came out during a pandemic.
Which I think is apropos for this conversation and this episode, because I bet you there's a lot of authors who are listening right now whose books are underperforming, and it's not because of the quality of our work. It's just our really bad timing, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what happened, I feel like, with my Mulan book. I had really high, I had high hopes for it. I really hoped that because it was a Disney book and it was connected to the movie, that it would really like kind of break open my readership, and people would like flock to the book because they were so excited about the movie, you know, and that it would do so well and it would sell lots. Like, I remember when I was first talking to the editor of the Mulan book, and they're like, oh yes, and the Beauty and the Beast book that we did, the middle grade novel, it was on the bestseller list for weeks and weeks, you know. And I have to admit, like, I had like these stars in my eyes, like, oh boy, maybe that'll happen to me. And of course it didn't. In fact, you know, the pandemic happened like three weeks after my book came out, and like, it just, I feel like it's just lost in obscurity. Like, I even now, the news that the movie is going to come out, and I put up a little Facebook post saying like, oh, since the movie's coming out, I thought this would be a good time to remind you that I did the prequel. And there were so many comments saying, oh, I had no idea you did this book. Oh, I had no idea, you know? So like, it was just lost. Like, people had no idea. Even people who were like readers of my work didn't know it existed, you know? So, so if they didn't know, then I realize it's unlikely that like new readers are coming to it. And I'm sure the sales are absolutely dismal, you know? So I think a lot of underperforming has to do with expectations, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. And expectations and timing
and that's hard because you don't want to have low expectations for your work, right? Like, you don't want to be like, oh, I don't expect anything, you know, like, which I think some authors fall back on because it hurts when it doesn't make those things. But at the same time, to have those low expectations is almost like setting yourself up for failure, I feel like, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I was thinking that in a way, you know, my kind of life philosophy has always been hope for the best, but prepare for the worst. And I think that that goes with publishing too. I mean, I think it's great to kind of have high hopes and, you know, imagine your book on the bestseller list and imagine your book getting 5-starred reviews and winning awards, but, you know, but also just be prepared that might not happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I guess what I meant, setting yourself up for failure is not so much that you should expect like starred reviews or like bestseller lists, but more like, I think that I guess they talk about this with kids a lot, with school, in school. If you have low expectations, then they're like, okay, well, I won't work hard. You know, like, whereas, right. like, That's if true. You have if you have higher expectations, like, oh, well, I think you're going to do really good at this. I know you can do really good at this. Then they'll be like, yeah, I can do really good at this, and I'm going to prove it, you know? So it's kind of finding that balance between the stereotypical Asian tiger mom that's like, you must get all A's versus the... Versus right. the like, oh, do whatever you want. It doesn't matter.
Like, I know. It's all about balance. That's tough. I mean, but publishing, you know, is a business. So there is the kind of underperforming expectations. And then there's the kind of like black and white, like, did your book make money or not? And that, so I think, well, I guess we should talk about both scenarios. I mean, because I guess the definition is what to do when your book underperforms. So for you, what did you do when you had those experiences of these books underperforming?
Well, for me, when I feel sad. I feel sad. I wallow in self-pity for a little while, but then after a while, I just sit back up and I write the next book. I mean, that's all yep. you can do. That's yeah. really all you can do. You know, when we were doing that SCBWI spectacular, we were talking about imposter syndrome. And I think that when your book underperforms, it just feeds that imposter syndrome so much. You're like, oh, I'm not worthy. Like, nobody wants my books. And it's kind of dangerous to let that imposter syndrome be fed, right? Mm-hmm. And for me, the way that I've always dealt with it is just to realize, like, okay, maybe the world doesn't need my work. Maybe the world doesn't need my art. But the truth is, I still need to make my art. Like, I need to make my art, even mm-hmm. if the world doesn't need it. And so when I take that attitude...
the world does need it.
Well, but when I take that attitude, I realize, like, okay, my only choice is just to sit up and make the next book. And yeah. And that has worked pretty well for me. That's the only thing I know for sure, and the only thing I can hold on to.
Yeah, I think, you know, publishing is a roller coaster. It's so rare. I mean, I think, you know, I think some people have the expectation of, you know, I write the first book and then the second book will do even better and the third book will do even better. And like they maybe picture this upward trajectory, but book publishing just does not work like that. And in fact, it's often the opposite, sadly, is where, you know, someone's first book is the best-selling of it all. You know, like, for example, I don't think we were that surprised that Starry River wasn't as popular as Where the Mountain Meets the Moon, because we knew that Where the Mountain Meets the Moon was that, like, special magic that you can't really replicate it. And often, not that it was, like, a series, but as a companion book, it's so rare. I mean, I can't, honestly, I don't know if I can think of an example where, like, a second or third book in a series outperforms the first book. You know, the first book always sells the most. I mean, that's the philosophy that it's not even a philosophy, it's the truth. So when we're setting up a series, you know, oftentimes, and this is kind of getting into the nitty-gritty kind of business aspect of it, but, you know, there's something called joint accounting. And so when you have a series, that means like the advance you get for each book kind of pools together into one big advance. And so you don't earn royalties until, you know, the books sell through that combined advance. So some agents and authors hate that, understandably so. But at the same time, for series, it totally makes sense because, you know, it doesn't make sense. Like, let's say book three bombs and the publisher loses like $50,000 on it. Why? But at the same time, we're paying royalties on book one, you know, like that, it's just not fair. Of course I'm biased and I'm speaking from the publisher's point of view. But so in cases where sometimes the agent just refuses to accept joint accounting, what we've often done is weight the advance towards book one. So we pay a higher advance for book one and a much lower advance for book two and three. You know, and that's something that we've done, and because that's just how sales tends to go. I think that all you can do is write the next book. I think that's what's magical about publishing and the, anything creative is, it is all about the work, right? I mean, we've seen movies where a director's movie will have a movie bomb and then maybe three bombs in a row. But if they're given, you know, usually if they're men, if they're given the opportunity to make like a fifth movie and all of a sudden that movie is the huge blockbuster. But it is rare, I think.
Yeah, and that's the problem about underperforming. It's like, how many chances do authors get? And that's something I wanted to ask you about in terms of this pandemic. Like, I think that there's a lot of authors whose books are probably underperforming right now. Like, are editors and publishers, like, taking that into account for, like, when they submit the next book, like giving them a little leeway, like
yeah for sure. And you know, I think there is some financial repercussions there, because as I think we've discussed on this podcast before, or maybe not, but you know, sales team, meaning when they're selling to accounts, it's all about competitive titles and comparable titles, comp titles, and also the author's previous sales. And so a lot of, like, Barnes & Noble might say, like, okay, well, we sold 500 copies of this author's previous book, even though we took in 2,000. So this time we're only going to take 600 copies, you know. Mm. So it does affect sales, and we're aware of that. You know, we have signed up future books by authors whose books were published right now during this pandemic. And, you know, sales has, like, you know, pandemic book, you know, and accounts know that, and, you know, we can use that, and, you know, we can, you know, confront that history and try to do better. But it is, you know, it does factor in. And, you know, but like I said, though, it is all about the book. So even if the first book bombed, you know, if we love the book and we love the second book, we are going to buy it if we feel like we can sell it, you know, like, so we definitely have had cases where, you know, let's say as an author who has published at many different publishers and doesn't have a great track record, but then the book is a different kind of a book. Maybe in the past the author wrote romance and now this is a thriller. You know, if they're switching genres, we can tell a new story. We can say, like, you know, like, yes, those previous books underperformed, but this book is really different, and this is the special book, and this is the breakout book. So it is all about telling the story and just,
like, changing the narrative of
it. Yeah, exactly. So, oh, and I meant to say, though, earlier when you were talking about success, and I remember we talked about this, oh, God, like, maybe 10 or 15 years ago, because I think I had published a few books that you thought were doing much better than they actually were, just sales-wise, right? And I think there's an example of perceived success. Mm. You know, I think you look, maybe it's on social media, or you just, like, you're hearing about this book everywhere, and maybe the book hit the best of the list, but maybe it was only for 1 week. And, you know, I think that there can be a huge discrepancy, I think, between perceived success and actual sales success, if that makes sense.
That's true. And that's an interesting thing too, because there's some people who are just so media savvy, social media savvy especially, you know, and so good at, like, not in a bad way, but so good at showing the good sides, you know, like, and you're like, man, they must be selling so much. But I mean, maybe I think that's not true.
Yeah, I think that goes, this goes towards the imposter syndrome. I mean, I think there is an argument to be made about fake it till you make it, you know, like, just... And the more you talk about your books, the more people will, like, notice, and then maybe they'll they'll buy it. I do think if your book underperforms, don't give up, because sometimes a book maybe doesn't do really well right out the gate, but maybe it can build momentum, you know, and maybe the topic you wrote about comes up in the news, you know, a year later, and then it can be re-promoted. You know, we had books that didn't really perform, or, you know, we had some books that underperformed in hardcover, but then, like, took off in paperback. And, you know, you just never know what that thing, that magic thing will be that will boost sales.
That's what's interesting, is because there's been this whole push for, like, pre-orders, which I actually don't mind. I think it's kind of fun to do pre-orders, because it kind of builds for me, when I was doing, before the pandemic, I kind of liked doing pre-orders because I tied it into my book launch. And when I did pre-orders, it was nice to know that there was a bunch of books that were going to be selling like that day, you know, all those mm-hmm. things. But I know a lot of authors feel a lot of pressure to do pre-orders because they feel like they only have like a short window to prove to the publisher and to the booksellers and to like the general public that their book's worth reading and like that I don't know if it's a myth or not, but there's a feeling that the long tail is shorter and shorter for books. Would you agree with that or no?
I wouldn't agree with that. I do think there's pressure more on the young adult side, I guess, for pre-order campaigns. And I think it's more because they want to hit the bestseller list. But I don't think, like, in reality, hitting the list, depending on which category you're publishing into and when you're publishing, hitting the list might not actually mean you're selling that many copies. And, you know, as has been reported, the New York Times list is mysterious. We have no idea how they calculate the bestseller list because we've seen examples of, you know, books that we've published that have sold more copies than other books that have hit the list, you know, and it's... So, but I do think there's this, like, cachet to hitting the list, and then you can say forever, I'm the New York Times bestselling author. So that's really the goal of pre-orders, is to amass enough sales in the first week that you hit the list, mainly. I mean, it can impact, mainly it can impact Amazon's buy of the book, like how many copies they buy. So, you know, there is some benefit, I guess, to collecting pre-orders, but... I mean, to be honest, not a lot of books and authors get that enough pre-orders for it to matter. Mm. And usually it has to be an established author that, you know, like Holly Black gets a lot of pre-orders because especially in when it's like she's in the middle of a series, you know, everyone's mm-hmm. like, oh, my gosh, I need the next book. But I think most authors don't really get a ton of pre-orders. So I would not worry about pre-orders in general. But no, I mean, I think in the children's book world, what we've always said is it is the long tail. And then especially if you're a book that maybe is more of a school and library type book, that is definitely much more of a slow burn, you know, because library orders come in later. And then, you know, if your book is adapted into curriculum, that could be not until the book is in paperback, for example. And mm-hmm. same with like state award lists, you know, oftentimes those lists don't happen till 3 years after your book comes out. And those lists can sell us so many books depending on which state. And so, you know, I would say if you feel like your book underperformed, don't give up. Like keep doing everything you can because you do never know when that one... You know, that tipping point, you know, I was talking about, you never know when that, like, one person who maybe can influence sales or, like, is selecting a one book, one read, you know, for their school or their you know, their city. I mean, that could be thousands of copies, so.
So I have a couple of questions. First, I wanted to know if you had a good example of a book that underperformed that you'd be willing to share.
Well, one that came to mind, I mean, this was a big acquisition. It was this dystopian trilogy called The Young World by Chris Weitz, who is a director and screenwriter. And he, you know, the book was great. It was a big auction that we won, you know, so we paid a lot of money for it. We put a lot of marketing into it. And, you know, the first book sold okay, but definitely not to expectations. And, you know, I think part of it was published during the fight that Hachette had with Amazon, where we lost our buy buttons. Mm-hmm. And it was also, you know, this was a dystopian trilogy at the tail end. Like, I think by the time it came out, we acquired it when the trend was still going, but by the time it came out, the trend was over. Although I have thought about this book during this pandemic, because it's about, it's set in New York City after a pandemic where anyone who wasn't going through puberty died. So it's called The Young World because only teenagers survived. And, oh, wow. You know, at the beginning of the pandemic, you know, when they said, oh, it doesn't really affect, you know, children, it made me think of this book. Anyway, the trilogy is amazing. And, you know, I think some people are still discovering it. But, you know, that is definitely an example of a book underperforming. But of course, I have lots of examples.
So when a book underperforms, what do you suggest an author do besides write the next book? Or maybe even what kind of next book? Should they write a book that's completely different or, you know?
So if you just have one, I would try to keep going. You know, ideally you have an agent that you trust who you can help strategize with. It might be that you switch categories or genres, you know, depending. But I think just write the next book, write the book that you really feel like you have to write. And then, you know, let your agent try to sell it. And, I think though that you have to understand that it might mean that you get a lower advance for that next book. You know, I think some authors think of advances as like their salary and that it should keep going up. You know, you keep getting a raise, but that's not the reality. You know, the advance is based on how many copies the publisher thinks that they can sell. So, you know, if your first book underperformed, and let's say you got a six-figure advance for that first book, you probably won't get that same six-figure advance for the second book if it's in the same genre and category. So again, like if you want to really change the story, then I probably would switch genres or categories. But if you really want to build yourself like as a middle grade author, and it's rare that like a book
bombs.
bombs. Yeah, it's rare that a book completely bombs.
Flops.
Like there should be flops. Yeah, there should be something that you can build on. So, but yes, I guess talk to your agent.
So I think one thing about underperforming is when one book does really well and then it's like the sophomore slump, it's mm-hmm. the second book that really underperforms. I think that's really hard. And maybe I had a little bit of that with The Starry River of the Sky too. Like it's the, mm-hmm. and do you have any ideas, suggestions about that?
Oh, gosh. I mean, again, it's expectations. So, I mean, I think the publisher, you know, will do their best to try to replicate, you know, the sales of that first book. But I think the publisher knows that it's rare, that a publisher will think that they can actually replicate that success. So, yeah, I guess just expectations again. And, you know, weigh success on different factors, too. So the truth is that I would say that it's probably only 50% of the books published make money. I mean, I don't know if that's the actual percentage, but it's not that far off if it isn't. So I kind of thought my philosophy for publishing books is I want every book that I publish to be some child's favorite book. Mm. And and that's my goal. And like, if you just affect the life of like one child, or you move, you know, one child to laugh or to cry, or one reader, you know, I don't know. I feel like that's success.
Yeah, I guess it's also redefining success. I mean, there's underperforming in the business sense, which happens quite often. But maybe if you redefine success as something like that, it's like, as long as it's one child's favorite book, as long as it's a book I'm proud of, like then if you can use that as a different metric, then you are less likely to underperform, you know? What helps a lot of books is the slow buy from schools and libraries and things. And, you know, now we're in pandemic and a lot of those books are not getting the buy from schools and libraries. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts about that.
Right. I mean, we have been, you know, we have like read aloud permissions for, you know, libraries and teachers, which I think actually also help and work as marketing. I mean, the truth is children's book sales are not down as much as other categories. So I think just keep doing the same thing. I mean, schools still have budgets. So, you know, I think they're probably working in different ways and maybe going to different things. But, you know, schools and libraries are still buying books, just not as many. I guess, I don't know. I guess it's just hold tight. And
write we'll the next
see.
Book.
Yeah, I mean, you know, on the other hand, a lot of media companies like the Today Show, you know, they have kind of expanded their kind of like book picks. And I know Reese Witherspoon, she expanded her like I think it's called Sunshine, I forget. But she, you know, she has an adult book club and she expanded it to young adult. So I do feel like there's some, you know, organizations and media companies that are kind of, you know, helping spread the word more about books. And then same with like Netflix and, you know, there's so many more movies. At the beginning of the pandemic, I think we had heard that like some movie studios were like panicking and then like looking to buy and option more books for to make movies. So yeah, I don't really.
I wish one of them would option mine.
I know. Maybe they will.
Maybe someday. Oh well. I'll have high expectations or low expectations. Trying to figure out what's better.
Hope for the best, prepare for the worst. All right. Well, I think now we'll end as we always do with what we're grateful for. So I'll start this week, and my grateful thing is a little silly, but it's also delicious. I'm here in Vermont, and, you know, when I came up, and maybe I even mentioned this before, but when I came up for my birthday, I tried one of these for the first time, and they are called Maple Creamies, and they're basically soft serve ice cream, but creamier and thicker, like a little bit more dense, and maple syrup flavored. And they have different flavors, but the Maple Creamy is the kind of Vermont specialty, and so now I'm kind of obsessed with them. And I've like tried three different places and, you know, kind of rated my favorites. So I would recommend Maple Creamies if you're ever in a place that serves them. And I'm grateful for them.
Now I want one.
Yes. Come to Vermont and visit and we'll have a Maple Creamy. What are you grateful for?
Well, I'm grateful for two things this week. One is something I've been working on all during the pandemic, little by little. It's been on my bucket list is to do make a little free library. So all during the pandemic, during craft camp, when the kids don't need my help, which is not as often as I wish, I would work a little bit on this little free library, and finally I finished it. Yay. And we just put it up a couple days ago, and I'm so happy to have it. Like, I've always wanted to have a little free library, and I'm so happy that it's done. So I'm very grateful for my little free library. It's painted, the cabinet part is a beautiful summer sky, like a blue sky with clouds on it, and then the door is like rainbow stripes. What I'm really proud about is that I painted with glow-in-the-dark paint, like constellations in the sky, and you can't really tell until it's dark out, right? So when it's dark, you can see the constellations, and I'm really proud of that. It's so cool. It's not as bright as I hoped, so I try to take photos of it so it doesn't really show it all in any photos, but if you're in real life and you can see it, and it's kind of really cool. So I'm very grateful for my little free library. And the second thing I'm really grateful for is my husband, not only for editing this podcast, but because he's always been so understanding when I'm so harried and crazy. Like, I sent my husband to the vet with one of our chickens, because one of our chickens has not laid an egg for like almost 2.5 weeks, and she's not doing well, so we're worried about her. So I made an appointment with the vet, and I sent the chicken with my husband to the vet like 8:30 in the morning, and he gets there and they're like, there's no appointment for you, no, we don't have you down. And he's like, are you sure? And then he comes back, and then he's like, "There said there's no appointment." And then I looked, and I realized I sent him on the wrong day. Like, it's not today. It's not today at all. It's like in 2 weeks. I felt so bad, like, to make him do all that, and like, because it's you know, you have to grab the chicken, you have to bring in all the car, all those things. And he was so understanding about it. He's like, "Yeah, it's all right." And I really appreciated that, because I felt terrible. So I really appreciate my understanding husband.
Yay. And now here's our two-minute book review segment featuring Allison Morris, Senior Director of Title Selection at First Book.
Hello, book friends. This week I am recommending another new graphic novel, and this is one that I think will have particular appeal to fans of books by Raina Telgemeier, Shannon Hale, and Jen Wang. Measuring Up by Lily Lamott and Anne Shu, spelled X-U, comes out October 27th. It is a story of a girl named Cece whose family has just moved from Taiwan to Seattle, where she is struggling to fit in and missing her grandmother. But she learns about a televised cooking competition that is looking for kid contestants, and she's got experience cooking, and realizes that if she wins the show, she will have enough money to bring her grandmother to the U.S. for a visit. However, the white American girl she is initially partnered with has very different ideas about what kinds of food are, quote, good and what flavors will wow the judges, raising big questions about bias, privilege, and the connections between food and cultural identity. Can Cece win an American cooking competition making Taiwanese food? Read this book to find out. It is a satisfying and surprisingly suspenseful story of food, identity, pride, and friendship that I thoroughly enjoyed and feel certain kids will too. Pre-order your copy now of Measuring Up by Lily Lamotte and Anne Hsu, coming October 27th. I'm Allison Morris. That's Allison L. Morris on Twitter and Kid Lit Girl on Instagram. Thank you for listening and have a great week.
Thanks for joining us, and thanks to Hachette Book Group, Hachette Audio, Little Brown Books for Young Readers, and Alex at PC Work Studio for producing and editing this podcast. You can find me at Planet Alvina on Twitter and at Alvina Ling on Instagram.
And I'm at Pacey Lynn on both platforms. We love hearing feedback, so keep tagging and messaging us on social media using the hashtag BookFriendsForever or send us a message via our website, BookFriendsForever.com. You can also see more detailed show notes there.
And if you have any suggestions for future topics to cover, please let us know. And of course, please remember to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. And if you like this podcast, please tell a friend about it. I'm Alvina Ling.
And I'm Grace Lynn.
Have a great week.
And don't forget to read!
Bye!